Jesus Christ, man. I'm kind of outnumbered, man. My name is Earl, and I'm an alcoholic. Jesus Christ. Hope the tape guy took his headphones off. Very grateful to be here. It's always an honor and a privilege to do something like this. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come out and share. It's an honor. And I used to drink alcohol. Insatiably. I drank alcohol. I drank a lot of it. I drank it till I almost died, and that's what got me here. Now, to fill that in a little bit, what got me to that was I didn't start drinking until I was 12 years old. My neck of the woods, they're coming in at 12, you know? But I didn't start till I was 12, and I didn't know I needed a drink. You know, my father had shipped me off to boarding school. He said, what had happened was that they'd given me a series of, I used to sleepwalk and talk in my sleep and scare the hell out of my parents in the middle of the night and go back to my bed, and they took me to a bunch of doctors and had a bunch of tests done on me, and every night before I'd go to sleep, they'd give me a tablespoon of this liquid and just knock me out, drug me, so I'd go to sleep. No more sleepwalking, no more problem, right? And I think subconsciously I got the information, if things aren't going right, take something. Kind of filed that for future reference and did some more tests on me, and the test turned up I had a very high IQ. I don't anymore, but I did. I was bright as a child. And so they decided to ship me off to this boarding school, and we got in the car one day, and I didn't even know where we were going. We drove off to this, drove, and we pulled up at this place, and I got out of the car, and my father put a suitcase down next to me and shook my hand and said, "This will make a man out of you," and got in the car, and everybody drove off. Scared the hell out of me. I had no idea what had just happened, and the fact is that I'd just been given an opportunity for a wonderful education. The feeling was that I'd just been thrown away, and I had absolutely no idea why. And it was, up to that point, the most devastating thing that ever happened to me. I was just completely horrified. And all I can remember feeling was afraid of everything and everybody. I was terrified of my own shadow. Turns out I was the youngest and the smallest kid in a school of 250 boys from all over the world. They had scoured the earth to find 250 of the most disturbed young men they could possibly find. And they put them in this school. It was like Lord of the Flies at this place, man. I mean, it was bad. And everybody there was 13 to 18, and I was 12. So I knew right off the bat, I don't fit here. I was 5 feet tall, 104 pounds, and 12 years old. I had no tools for living. Up to that point, I hadn't needed any. I mean, Mom and Dad had it pretty much covered. And I needed some tools fast. About the third day, I made a real calm decision. They don't want me, I don't want them. So I pretty much let my family go when I was 12 years old. I was walking through the campus, and about the fourth or fifth day there, and I met Tiny. Every high school has a guy named Tiny. You know, 6'2", 240, right? Loves finding guys like me, right? And I'm walking along, and he came up to me, and he said, "How you doing, punk?" And he slapped me in the back of the head and knocked my books flying and me flying, and I mean, I don't know what to do with this, you know? So I had like this out-of-body experience, you know, where you're like watching yourself do something, and your head is saying, "This is a very bad idea. I don't think you should be doing this." And I walked up and I hit him as hard as I could, which had absolutely no effect on him whatsoever. And I just stood there and looking up at him like, you know, man, you're going to have to take it from here, Tiny, because we're so far past anything I know anything about. You know. And he looked down at me and he said, "You got a lot of guts, kid." And then he beat the crap out of me right on the spot. And as I was taking this beating, I was thinking, this isn't going so bad. This is going pretty good, because what was more important to me than any, I'd taken a lot of beatings. I know how to take a beating. The thing that was important to me was I was absolutely terrified of this guy. And he had just said, "You got a lot of guts." My violence, my aggressive behavior had masked the fear successfully. First tool in my life. They frighten you, attack them. Which meant, if you got it within 5 feet of me, you were in danger. Because I was basically afraid of everybody. And word spread across this campus like wildfire, watch out for this little Hightower kid, he's a maniac, he attacked Tiny. Right? So now I got this reputation that has absolutely nothing to do with who I am. I mean, it's just getting deeper by the minute, you know? And I'm thinking, I can't do this life thing. I'm 12 years old, and I'm figuring the life thing is over my head. Enter Matt. Matt walks, the cool guys started coming around, the bad boys, right? Matt walks up to me and says, you want to smoke a joint? I said, well, yeah. I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. I had no idea what that meant. But the fact of the matter was, I was currently alone in the universe. I was alone, and I needed to hook up now. It would have made no difference to me where he was going or what he was going to go do. He could have come to me and said, listen, I'm going to go kill a Spanish teacher. Do you want to go? I'd have said, well, yeah, I'll go with you. I got to hook up. So we swung on out of the dorm, and I was, you know, just trotting along behind Matt. We picked up Steve. Steve had a Tupperware container wrapped in tin foil. My life was about to change, and I didn't know it. Dramatically. And we went out behind the dorm, me, Matt, and Steve, and Matt lit up this joint and took a hit off it, handed it to me, and I just kind of did what he did and handed it over, and Steve was over there unwrapping this tinfoil, and you could tell by the way he was unwrapping it that what was in here was very important. He was very careful in this. And he opened this up, and he popped the lid, and he had a Tupperware container full of cheap red wine. Cheap red wine. No grapes involved. Just, you know? Yeah, that fortified stuff, you know? And he took a pull and he handed it to me, and I did a pull. So we got the joint going, the wine's going, and I'm just looking at these two guys like, you know, I have no idea what's going on here. You know, and they're talking, and I mean, it happened. The magic happened. This warm feeling went right down into my shoes and right back up over me, and for the first time in my long, lonely 12 years, I knew everything was going to work out. I knew it was going to work out. I didn't know why. I just knew it all of a sudden. I just knew that the secret to life had been revealed to me behind this dormitory. I mean, here I was with my two best friends, Matt and Steve. And I didn't know if it's this pot or this wine or what it is or some kind of weird combination. I don't know. It makes no difference to me. I have never before been comfortable standing where I'm standing, doing what I'm doing with the people I've been doing it with. I've never felt this way. This is the most remarkable, wonderful thing I have ever felt in my life, and I'm going to do this as often as I possibly can. And so begins the next 16 years of my life on a daily basis. I mean, I got humble beginnings, you know, a little pot, a little wine, here we go. And the thing that I have to remember from the beginning is that why not do it? I paid no price for that. I didn't even need a Tylenol the following morning. Paid no price for that gift, that tremendous sense of ease and comfort that I had never before experienced. Why shouldn't I go after it? Made perfect sense. So I did. Now, I'm a child of the 60s. That's just the era I was brought up in. And everybody in my era was focused on drugs. So was I. Because that's the thing that differentiated us from our drunken parents. I mean, we weren't gonna drink ourselves like to death like they were doing. We were gonna kill ourselves in a whole new way. Separate ourselves from our parents. So everybody was focused on the drugs. It was our time and it was our thing. So I was very focused on it, and I mentioned them, but I gotta tell you, going in, I identify as an alcoholic because that's what I am. Because I drink alcohol alcoholically. And when I look back in retrospect, I understand two things that I did not understand as I was going through it. And I learned this through my inventory work. The number one thing that I learned is that no matter what else was going on in my life, there was only one thing that was always on the table. Other stuff would come and go. There was only one thing that was always on that table, booze. That was the thing that was on the table. And the reason for that is because drugs are unreliable. And alcohol is not. Alcohol is extremely reliable. I mean, in the drug world, there's no quality control going on out there. You know what I'm saying? You have no idea what you're getting. You have no idea what you're getting. You go get yourself a fifth of Jack Daniels, you know what you got. Right? It was very important information for me. And the last 5 years I was out there, all I did, I had no use for any of that whatsoever. I just drank, because drinking is the only thing that worked. Anyway, 13, somebody walked up to me and asked me if I wanted a couple of these pills, and I said, well, yeah. I had no idea what they were. Handed them to me, I took them. 20 minutes later, I was laying on the floor and real comfortable down there. Said, can I get you anything else? No. Fine. 14 years old, a woman said to me, would you like to drop some acid? I said, well, yeah, sure. You know, took some. The next 2 days were real interesting. 15, a woman walked up to me and said, how'd you feel about me sticking this in your body? And I said, well, yeah, all right. Injected me with something. I did like this. And as I was going down, I was thinking, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That'll work. So, I mean, for me, it was just if somebody offered me something, I just took it. It didn't make any difference to me whatsoever. At all. As long as the booze was there. Because, like I said, drugs are unreliable. I mean, you do so much cocaine, you can't get your mouth open anymore. You just, you know, you suck a little gin through your teeth, you can go back to party. You're all right. Acid gets a little too spooky, don't worry about it. Jack will get you back in the comfort zone. Just start sucking on the bottle, right? Not enough heroin to get you through the night? It's no problem. Quart of gin, you're home. You can get to that cool, quiet, dark place that is my best friend. That place where heart and lungs are working, nothing else going on. I like that place. That's the place for me. And you know what? I never could understand why, from the very beginning, I drank to get drunk. I can't even comment on. I mean, I've heard people talk negatively about social drinking from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have experiences different than mine. I don't know anything about it. I have no experience with social drinking at all. I've never done it. I don't know anything about it. I don't understand the point of it. I don't understand. And I never tried. I never tried. Drinking for me was, you do it to get drunk. I mean, that's the whole point. I never, when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous a while, I kept thinking, why was it that I did it that way? And I think the real reason is that I am a self-centered, frightened individual. And it's the fear that makes it impossible for me to feel comfortable anywhere. Because I'm always afraid. I'm always afraid. And my whole life is about killing that fear or making sure you don't know about the fear. One or the other. That's what all my tools for living are about. My tools for living are drugs, alcohol, violence, and run. Those are my tools. Those are the tools that I used till I got here. Because they worked for me for pretty much any situation that I would get into. The reason I drank alcoholically was alcohol was the fear killer for me. And it's the last thing I feel. That's why I got to get drunk. I mean, I got a barrel of emotions inside me, and swimming around up on the top of this barrel are all kind of feelings. I mean, I don't know anybody, and I'm feeling them all, you know, just here comes a feeling, there's another feeling, here goes another feeling, there goes another feeling. I don't know anybody that just feels happy for 8 days, you know, and then shifts gears and goes into another feeling. I think I'll be mildly depressed for a couple of days, you know. I'm tired of this, right? I'm going to be amused for 3 weeks, you know. It doesn't work like that. You know what I mean? It just kind of comes and goes. I mean, since I have been in this room, I guarantee you I felt fear. I damn near sucked all the air out of the room when y'all said hello. Confusion, irritability, happiness, gratitude, lust. I felt them all since I've been sitting up here. Enough about me. Oh, man. But see, I can drink through those real quick. I can blast through that stuff. That's all swimming around up on the top of the barrel that are my emotions. Way down in the bottom of that barrel, that deep undercurrent that is running my ass is fear. That's the thing that runs me. And I got to drink all the way down to the fear. Fear is the last thing I feel. And if I'm here drinking to kill the fear, I got to get drunk. I've got to black it all out. So blackouts were the normal fare for me. I mean, I blacked out so many times. I don't know. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. I do know that my limit for being blacked out is 4 days. I got so many blackouts where I can't remember 4 days. that seems to be my body has to wake up at that point. Or wake me up at that point. I don't know. Anyway, let's get sober. Tired of this. It's making me tired, all this drinking. God. So, I mean, those were the beginnings. I hit the 16, I got committed to my first mental institution. I dropped out of high school. Figured 4 years of Latin was plenty for me. Hit the street. My father came back in my life, said, "You've obviously lost your mind." I said, "How would you know? You ain't been around for 4.5 years. He said, "That's cute." Threw me in a mental hospital. I hung out in the mental. They put me in for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation, which I thought was a little dramatic. And they had these, they had exit signs just like they have in here, these that are lit up over the doors, say exit, except these are red and those were green. And I used to look at those and think, that just simplified everything I was feeling while I was in the nut house. That's all I would like to do is just exit. Exit's the word. What do you want to do? Right there, exit. That's what I want to do. And I remember one day I was having lunch with Kilday. Kilday should remain anonymous. How that woman's still alive, I don't know, but in case she is. Kilday, I would have lunch with Kilday every day because Kilday was insane. And lunch was like dinner and a show, having lunch with Kilday. You know what I mean? It was really entertaining eating with her. So I would sit and she'd just be snapping like crazy over there. And I decided I was going to bust out of this joint. Now, I'd been shuffling around this hospital for weeks, taking my little 3 cups of pills a day and talking to my psychiatrist for 15 minutes a day, who would come in and ask me how I felt. How would I know how I feel? I've been loaded since I was 12. What do you... Stupid question. And I decided to bust out of there, and I'm sitting in this, I'm sitting in the dining room, and I decided to make my break, and I got ready in my chair, and I said, "Ready, ready, ready, go!" You know, and I was hauling ass, you know what I mean? I didn't know about what was in those little cups of pills that they've been giving me. Because I'm sitting around in this joint for weeks thinking, you know, at a normal speed, I'm thinking everything's fine, right? I don't know that the pills, they've reduced me to 2 speeds, slow and seated. That's all I got, you know? But I'm an alcoholic, man, you know what I mean? Just as I think I'm running, I mean, I got my arms are working, you know what I mean? My head's down, you know? I'm going. I'm thinking, screw it. I'll just keep going. I just kept shuffling. And you hear from the nurse's station over the loudspeaker system, you hear, "Ed, when you got a second, you want to grab Earl? He's making a break for the door." You know? You know, Ed's over there having a sandwich going, "Yeah, yeah, I'll get him in a minute." Yeah. Back to the room with no doorknob. Tools for living. If you're going to live my life and get thrown in the nut house, you got to get out before they get the pills in you. Because if you don't, you leave when they say. So I did started interacting with my psychiatrist a little better at that point and talked my way out of that joint. Next time they threw me in the nut house, I escaped the first day. Sitting in the intake process, thinking, saying, "Oh, geez, boy, I'm really glad you got me. It's brutal out there. It's vicious. I couldn't have made it another day. I'm so glad to be here. Hey, look at that." And I'm hauling ass again, right? Through those exit signs, right? A sense of completion doing that, you know what I mean? I'm out the exit signs, I'm in the backyard, I got an intern run on my tail, we're going for the chain link fence, I'm moving, man. And in my head, I mean, at that moment, I mean, I'm a high school dropout. I'm a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. I'm at any moment, hopefully, an escaped mental patient. I mean, that's like my resume. That's who I am. That's all I got to say for myself. Right? And I'm going for this fence, and I'm thinking, if I make that fence, I don't have a problem. I don't have any problems, because I'll be drunk in 20 minutes I get over that fence, and that's all that matters. Because you see, I drink no matter what. Now, my neck of the woods, there's some people that say stuff that personally really pisses me off. They say, they look at newcomers and they tell them, "Just don't drink or use no matter what, pal." And they walk away. And I think to myself, hey, thank you very much. You know, that really addresses my particular problem. You know, I feel a whole lot better now. Just don't drink or use. If I could do that, if I could somehow manage to just not drink, no matter what, I guarantee you I wouldn't be here tonight. What the hell for? I don't know anybody in Nebraska. Why would I come here? And when I tell you a little more of my story, I mean, you know, no way I'm getting on an airplane. No way I'm getting on an airplane. Not going to do it. I'd just be home with a remote control in one hand, a little iced tea in the other, just not drinking no matter what. That's what I'd be doing. Wouldn't be going to meetings, wouldn't have a sponsor, wouldn't be reading in the big book, wouldn't have gone anywhere near those 12 steps. I'd just be home on the couch, not drinking no matter what. See, the point is, I drink no matter what. I'm the other way. Gotta tell you, it's really weird to have the fellas up there like that, looking over your shoulder. Oh, man, that's some heat, you know? His eyes follow you, too, if you walk around. Bill doesn't let go of you, man. It just... All right. Settle down, Earl. I drink no matter what. No matter what. It's the difference between me and a problem drinker. Given a good reason, he'll stop. Not me. I mean, it's evident in every area of my life. I mean, you take a problem drinker and you put him before the judge for another 502, and the judge looks at him and he says, "Partner, I see you one more time in my court for 502, you're doing a year. No conversation this time. None. I see you, the gavel bangs, you go for a year. Do the whole year, that's it." Problem drinker says, "I don't want to do a year." Stops drinking. Me, I start wondering what it's going to be like in jail. I'm going. Same thing with a relationship. Problem drinker's got a good relationship. Woman loves him. She says, "Honey, you know, I love you and more than anything, you know, but this drinking, it's killing the both of us. You don't stop drinking, I got to go." Problem drinker says, "Well, I love this woman. You know, I got a lot of invest in this relationship. I got to stop the drinking." He actually does it. Me, I start wondering what it's going to be like to be single. Because she doesn't get it. I remember one time I was living with a woman in Redwood City, California. I don't know why. And some people had been over, and we'd just gotten a little high, and they'd left, and I turned around, and she looked at me, and she said, "I'm too high." I thought, oh, darling. And first of all, if you can say it, it's not true. And secondly, we need to talk about our living arrangements, because you got to go. We're still friends. I actually married her 3 years later for one day. Hey, the party was over. It's time to go. Oh, man. Where was I? Hopping the fence, hitting the street. So, I get out of the nut house. I spend the next 3 years out on the street. Drinking, using, no matter what. Through a series of circumstances, only a good little alcoholic like me can create, I ended up in college. I know. You know, I had met this woman, and I decided that we needed to hook it up and do something right, and I needed to become a provider of some kind. I mean, I didn't know how to do anything legal, and. I went on and I heard this guy was interviewing for a prestigious business college in Northern California, so I went to on an interview. I mean, I was a high school dropout. Went on a college interview. Sat down with this guy for an hour and a half. You know, he was a musician, so I was a musician. His favorite color was blue. I said, "It's incredible. My favorite color is blue." I mean, I just lined right up with this guy. End of an hour and a half, he said, "You know, you're going to be an excellent addition to our campus in the fall." And I got accepted to this college. So now I'm like, one more time, I've talked myself into something. There's no way I can back it up. So I went and saw my father, and I said, "Listen, I got accepted to college. Don't ask. If you'll write a check for the tuition, I'm leaving town." He said, "Beautiful." Wrote me a check, handed it to me. Me and this woman piled all our belongings and 8 pounds of hash in the back of this truck and went to Northern California. You know? So we set up shop up there, and I went to gave him a check for the tuition, told him the transcripts are in the mail. They told me don't worry about it. Which was a good thing, because I didn't have them. Went and got my GED for high school at night while I'm going to college during the day. I'm dealing drugs on campus. I was a bunch of rich kids going to school, and I'm dealing them all drugs. I'm studying marketing, production, distribution. I'm applying it to my business. Business is booming. I think this college thing is the best, right? Right about 20 years old, they diagnosed me to have malignant cancer. Sort of burst my bubble a little bit. Flew back to L.A., had major surgery for cancer on my back. They put me on the nuclear medicine routine, you know what I mean? You're showing up at the hospital and getting injected with glow-in-the-dark stuff, you know, and I was going, and I just wasn't enjoying this at all, this whole thing. So I told them, screw it, I don't want to take your drugs anymore. And I just went home and got loaded my way. Well, I beat the cancer thing. I'm thoroughly convinced that I was using it such a horrific rate at that point in my life, the cancer could not live in my body. Cancer just said, no, no. We'll go someplace else. This is absolutely ridiculous here. So I just kept going and going like that. When I was 21, my mother called me and said, we haven't been anywhere as a family in 10 years. Your 22nd birthday is coming. We'll go anywhere you want to go. Let's just go as a family. And she was crying and pulling those mother tricks on me. I said, all right. And I flew back to Los Angeles, and we got in my father's plane and took off to fly to Guadalajara. And on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother and my father and my little sister were all killed, and I wasn't. And I woke up on this mountain in Mexico, and my skull was fractured, and my back was broken in three places, and my leg was crushed, my arm was crushed, and I was paralyzed from the waist down, and I was awake. And I couldn't move, and I laid there and I watched them all bleed to death. And I made a decision that I had absolutely no interest in a God that would do such a thing. Leave a lying, cheating, thieving little dope fiend alcoholic like me alive and take somebody like my little sister. My little sister and I were very close. We were 15 months apart, and she was mine. When she had problems, she came to me. When she wanted to know about boys, she came to me. And I was very proud to be her big brother. And when she died, I had no interest in a God that would do such a thing. So I just quietly removed God from my life. And then some guys came up the mountain and scavenged the plane, the wreck, took my wallet out of my pocket while I was laying in the mud there, took the money out of it, dropped the wallet back on my chest, and left me up there to die. I had no use for you anymore either. So I was alone in the world again. No God, no other people. I had no interest in any of it. I was one angry little maniac laying on that mountain. The only thing I could move was my right arm, and I kept banging myself in the side because it hurt so bad, so I'd keep out of the shock so I could stay alive on the mountain. And I was up there, I don't know how long I was up there, and some guys from the Mexican Red Cross found me, and they took me down the mountain and took me to a Red Cross station and tagged my right toe and waited for me to die, which pissed me off. They finally took me to a hospital, and they patched me up enough to fly me back in the States, and spent a long time in a hospital in Santa Monica, California, and I came out of there as crazy as I've ever been in my life. I came out of there, and I went on my last run. It lasted for 4.5 years, and I was... Drugs were completely unreliable. The drugs couldn't get the pictures that were in my head out of my head. So I was overdosing a lot. Went down to the basement one day and picked up a fifth of J&B Scotch. Wasn't my preferred drink. It just happened to be the closest bottle to the door. And I picked it up and I drained it. And I passed out. And when I woke up, actions on me. What do I seek them for? I seek God through prayer and meditation. That's why we do it. And what am I praying for? Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. That's it. I got to keep it simple for me. The first prayers I ever got from my sponsor, I was going to Ohio Street for like 2 years, and I said, there's a big painting right behind the podium there that's the Serenity Prayer. After 2 years, I spotted it. And I called up my sponsor and I said, excellent prayer. Shortest one I found. He said, no. What do you mean no? He says, there's too much in there. You'll screw it all up. And he was right. Rarely, I can't go any. He said, here's your prayers. When you get up in the morning, I want your feet to hit the floor, and I want you to look up, and I want you to say, whatever. So that was my morning prayer. When I finished the day, I would get in bed at night, and I would pull the covers up to my head, and I would look up, and I would say, enough. Those are my prayers. They're great. Try them. I called him up one day at 9 o'clock in the morning and I said, Jesus Christ, Donald, I'm screwed. I'm doomed. I'm doomed. He says, what's wrong? He says, I'm at enough. It's 9 a.m. I'm a dead man. He says, all right, I can help you here. I said, please. That's why I called. So take a deep breath. Now say enough. Enough. Okay, now take another deep breath. Okay, now say whatever. You can do that? That was like a spiritual experience for me. I thought I had to do till in the bed thing. That was all, I mean, no, that's what you get. Unbelievable. Unbelievable freedom for me that came out of that. Tremendous gift. The gifts I got from this man are absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I'll talk about that in 1 second. But step 12 was having had a spiritual awakening as the result of doing these steps. It was the whole point. The result. The only point of doing this. A spiritual awakening. I can practice these principles and carry the message. Third side of the triangle. Unity is the body, I bring it here. Recovery is the mind, I got to work those steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of that, third side of the triangle, service. I can be of service. I've got something to give. I have purpose. I had no purpose before I got here. None. It was a completely wasted, useless life. And all of a sudden, I found myself an individual with purpose, who was clearly on a specific spiritual path that I had the utmost faith and confidence in. I came here a hopeless, hope-to-die, dope fiend alcoholic. That's how I got here. I had no hope. I got hope here. I became a hopeful man. And I've stayed and done all the things that I'm supposed to do in here, working those three sides of that triangle on a daily basis. I practice the principles on a daily basis. I am of service on a daily basis. I am in contact with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis. I sponsor a lot of guys now. Some of them I've sponsored for me for a lot of my sobriety. I'm 13 years and 9 months sober, and I'm a guy that could not stay sober a day. Now, 13 years, and it's all in your perspective. That's punk time to some guys, you know what I mean? And I respect that. I do. And I really enjoy meeting guys at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous who scoff at my 13 years. Because that means there's guys there with a lot more time. And it makes me feel good that they're there, you know? You can pat me on the head all you want, man. I'm just really glad to see you, you know, at a meeting. So if you're in here and you got more time than me, thank you. Thank you for continuing to participate in this program. And if you got less time than me, congratulations. It's a remarkable journey. This goes so far past not drinking, it's unbelievable. It's a process of living. It's a design for living. It's beyond your wildest dreams. If you know, I'll guarantee you, it's beyond your wildest dreams. I mean, I've read lots of interesting stuff, you know, paths to God. I mean, I've read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I've read, you know, the Mustard Seed, and I've read the Sermon on the Mount, and the Bible, and the Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and the Celestine Prophecy. I mean, I've read all of this stuff. Great stuff. Great stuff. But there's something we do that's different than that. You read all that stuff, and then you talk about it, and you try to expose yourself intellectually to this path to God, to achieve ascension of some kind, to enlighten as you move forward. In here, what we do is we get down in the dirt with each other and we share our experience, strength, and hope. And we rise up out of a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It's not the looking up as much as it is getting down in the dirt. Getting down in the dirt, getting down on our knees and doing the things that we do in here to stay clean and sober. The best example of Alcoholics Anonymous I have ever known in my life is a gentleman by the name of Donald Madden. He was my sponsor. This is going to be hard, but I got to do it. Donald Madden, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous a shell, a worthless human being. He took me in as his sponsee, and he rebuilt me from the ground up. Personally, he was the only man on earth I trusted for 2.5 years. And all of the things I learned in that original 2.5 years I got from that one man. One man. And when I was ready, he gave me to another man, and then another, and I developed friends. And as a result, today I have a complete life. I didn't know how to make a living. He had a factory. He said, paint the factory. I'd show up every morning and paint on his factory, and he'd feed me dinner and tell me to go to a meeting, and I'd show up the next morning, and we'd do it again. And when we'd finished painting the factory, he said, you know how to paint. Go get a job. Gave me a way to go out in the world and make a living. That's so far beyond what's expected of a sponsor. It's unbelievable. And I mean, the gifts go on and on and on and on and on. Only sponsor I've ever had. Only one.
the most important person in my life, period. Whatever I am that's of value today is the result of my relationship with that man and his commitment to this program and his sharing that with me. 27 days ago, he died. And I was devastated. It absolutely broke my heart. It was the most pain I'd ever experienced in my life. And I was going to feel his pain sober and didn't know how I could do that. Do you want to know that it never even occurred to me to drink? That's how good a teacher he was. And that's how powerful a program this is. I was absolutely on the floor dying. And I went to, but I hear his voice. Because somehow the man, as a member of this program, prepared me for even this. And I went to where he was, and we waited for them to come to take the body. And before he was even gone, I had a new sponsor. So I knew if I didn't do it, I never would. And I called up a man that I knew loved him and respected him, that I loved and respected. And I said, Donald is gone, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes. So I had a new sponsor within 3 hours. And we had a beautiful memorial service for him, and hundreds of members of Alcoholics Anonymous showed up and said absolutely phenomenal things about this man and about how he had touched their lives and changed their lives in a positive way. And I got to see the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous demonstrated on a day like that, and it healed me a lot. Healed me a lot, because I was open to the healing. I mean, the grief that I'm experiencing is not this big dramatic thing, and it's not. I'm not shutting down on it. I'm somewhere in the middle because there's some balance in my life as a result of unity, recovery, and service. And I'm able to just feel these feelings and move forward in my life. During the last, when we buried him, and it's just been tough for me since we buried him. During this summer, my wife's had a miscarriage. My sponsor died. A very good friend of mine died of a heart attack. I got viral pneumonia. I mean, it was just like building up on me, right? And when Donald died, I got there. I felt like standing up and clenching my fist and saying, all right, God, what is the point? What is your point? But something I learned in here from you, I just couldn't quite get my hands clenched and up before I was sinking to my knees. And I got down on my knees, and I looked up and I said, what do you want me to do? And on my mother's grave, the phone rang. And I picked up the phone and I said, hello. And it was a guy with 7 years that said, I've been wanting to ask you to sponsor me for a year. Will you sponsor me? And am I glad he waited a year? Because I needed him right that moment. And I said, yes, I will. Let's talk about you. And I got to get out of me for a little bit. It works. See, these things work. They're of value. They're pertinent to my life on a daily basis. This is an absolutely phenomenal program. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Beyond my wildest dreams. And there's a lot of great stuff in my life. I can say, yeah, I drive the car I want. I live in a nice house down in Redondo Beach. I'm making money. This is going on. That's going on. You know what? A lot of fluff. You know? A lot of fluff. The miracle of my life is that I'm sober. The miracle of my life is that I'm sober and I'm as committed to this program as I am. I don't commit to anything. You've got to know, based on my story, what it means for me to get on an airplane and fly someplace. So far, I will only do it for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just too intense for me. I got here and slept 11 hours last night because I'd been on planes flying from L.A. to here, from L.A. to Phoenix and Phoenix to here with up and down and the bumping and the thing, and I'm losing my mind the whole way. And I got here. And you know what? I'll never say no to doing it. Never. You can't scare me bad enough to get me to say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's much scarier to me than anything else anybody or anything could do to a guy like me. If you're new, congratulations. Congratulations. You have stepped in it now. You stepped in it now, man. These look like normal people to you, don't they? They're all kind of dressed. They got their hair combed. They're all sitting facing the right way, you know? They look like normal people. We're not. We're not normal human beings. We are bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And that is demonstrated in the things we think, the things we do, and the way we feel. Just every single heartbeat, something different is going on with us that we constantly have to reevaluate, give to God, and come up with some way of trying to be a service to the situation we're in so that we can remain sober individuals and members of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a remarkable, remarkable place to be. Those guys gave it to us. Bill and Dr. Bob, they gave that to us. I had the pleasure once, I had lunch with Dr. Bob's son one day. And I've met a lot of people in my life. You know, and I figured it was pretty hard at this point in my life to be impressed. I just sat there with my mouth hanging open looking at this guy. It's going, "You were there, man." He goes, "Yeah, I was right there the moment it started," he said. "And you want to know something? You got to believe everything I tell you about it because everybody else is dead." And I said, "Great. Tell me." And I got to talk. I mean, just the gifts are boundless. You know, the gifts are boundless. The main gift for a guy like me is that I'm free. You know, I'm loving and being loved, and I'm free. And I've been a slave all my life. I've been locked away all my life. I've never been free. I've never been comfortable. And I got to tell you, I'm standing right now in front of God knows how many people, one of the greatest fears of my life. And I'm comfortable being who I am, doing what I'm doing, with the people I'm doing it with. And that's a freedom beyond my wildest dreams. If you're new, please stay here. If you're old, please stay here. And thank you very much for letting me participate.